most recently, I worked with him on The Interpreter, and it's a fabulous online journal of scholarship that covers not only believers' ideas in a church setting, but also in other realms as well of education and academic scholarship. And he will speak for himself. I'm sure you will all be richly rewarded. We are going to be recording tonight. He will be having it recorded and put up on the Interpreter website as well as on our Institute website. So turn it over to Dan. I'll mute myself so you can get all the...
Well, thank you. It's good. I was going to say it's good to be here, but I'm where I almost always am. So I'm not really there at all, of course, but I wish I could be out there in Palo Alto, Stanford. It would be a lot of fun, but here we are. I'm going to start off by sharing some video footage from a project that I'm involved with right now. The Interpreter Foundation that I'm the president of has undertaken to make a movie, actually a set of movies, films, a theatrical film on the witnesses to the Book of Mormon called simply Witnesses, and then a documentary to go along with it. And we're hoping to put up short little items to sort of flood the internet with them to cover all the kinds of questions and objections and so on that come up in connection with the witness testimonies. And so I have four, I hope they're not too much, but I have four clips from the film. They're not quite finished. The film is essentially finished, but I'm learning a lot about filmmaking in this process. And one of the things that I've learned is that it's only at the very end that they go through and they redo all of the color to make it uniform, because every camera has its own personality and its own lighting, and every microphone has its own characteristics. And so they totally strip the sound out and then redo it to make it uniform again. So these four clips have not had the sound made uniform. They haven't had the color smoothed out. And so I'm going to try to do this. Now, I have to confess that my technological expertise is roughly on the site, you know, in the period of the pre-abacus. So I'm hoping this is going to work. And I have a good friend, Tom Pittman, who's here with me, in the almost certain event that it doesn't for me. He's going to help me make it work. So Tom, watch me and see if I do it right. I want to share the screen, and then I want to bring up this, and we'll see how it goes.
I have them.
What happened?
I was attacked.
How many?
Three.
Blasted thievers!
You won't catch them. Hiram.
You may not see them.
No. I intend to keep my promise.
That's enough, Catherine.
It's okay, Ma.
Go ahead. Just keep them covered.
It was as though Joseph and Oliver had long known each other. They talked late into the night.
Joseph readily accepted Oliver's offer to scribe. Rather than try to retranslate the lost pages, they moved forward with the work.
Are you ready? Of course. And now, if God, who has created you, on whom you are dependent for your lives and for all that ye have and are. Are you getting this?
Oh, yes.
Oliver.
Yes?
You need to write this exactly as I dictate.
And now, if God, who has created you, on whom you are dependent for your lives and for all that ye have and are,
doth grant unto you whatsoever ye ask that is right. In faith, believing, ye shall receive.
Mr. Harris, this Joe Smith, now he asked you for money. For what purpose?
He never asked me for money.
But you gave him money?
Yes.
And he promised you what in return, Mr. Harris?
He promised me nothing. He asked for nothing. He defrauded no one. I did once, of my own free will and accord, put $50 into his hands in the presence of witnesses for the purpose of doing the work of the Lord. And as to these plates he professes to have, if you continue to resist the truth, it will one day be the means of damning your souls.
Order, Your Honor, do something.
Order.
I will do something. The only people who have given Mr. Smith any money are your client and her husband, both willingly. I see no evidence that anyone was defrauded of anything. This is folly. Case dismissed.
Oh, we're tired of you Mormons!
Yeah! Yeah!
And we just want you to leave one way or another. All you gotta do is admit that you and Joe Smith made it up. That no angel showed you no gold plates. I'll let you and your friends go. But if you don't...
I am afraid I might disappoint you.
What do you mean?
The truth is, it is not a lie. God Almighty knows that I have seen the gold plates. And I fear him a lot more than I fear you. I know what I have seen! I know what I have promised! I will not deny what I have learned about my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
He is my Savior.
Let him go.
Why?
Well, I will talk while Tom looks. let me say something about that film project. One of the best comments that I heard about it when we showed it to a small group of people the other day was that it's not a church film. And they meant that as a compliment in the sense that we're trying to take on every tough issue. That is, the film does mention issues why the witnesses left the church. That we talk about the Kirtland Bank failure. We talk about the origins of plural marriage and so on. And so you see real tension between between Joseph and the witnesses and an explanation of why they leave. We felt if we didn't do that, then people could justly say, well, you're not being honest, you're whitewashing history, that sort of thing. And we felt we just have to be frank about all of this. We're going to try to address every issue, not necessarily in the theatrical film, but in the snippets and so on, other accompanying materials, every issue that people raise of any substance about the witnesses. You know, was Martin Harris unstable? Did Oliver Cowdery deny his testimony? All those sorts of things. We're convinced that we have a really good story to tell. And that we win on these issues, but they have to be addressed frankly or it compromises us. So that is what we're trying to do. Now, I've titled this talk, this is going to be a boiled down and not simplified, but more chatty version of something that I presented recently at Fair Mormon. But it makes, I think, some important points, and not the only points, important points that could be made about the witnesses. So I've titled this one, The Witnesses' Variety and Complexity, and I'll try to explain what I mean by that as we proceed. So it's being sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, so on, a little commercial there. But I wanted to stress something. We don't use the word apologetics very often in the church, but there's nothing nasty about it. The word is actually, in a sense, biblical. You're familiar maybe with this passage in 1 Peter, sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, be ready always to give an answer. And the word in the Greek is apologian, and give an apology, like Socrates' apology, which is by no means an apology in our modern sense when he appears before the court in Athens. It's a defense of himself and his course. Be ready to give an answer to every man that asketh you, a reason of the hope that is in you. And I think it's important that we do that. It's important that we have good spiritual experiences and so on, but when we're talking with other people and with wavering members, we need to be able to say, to some degree, why we believe what we believe, and to cite some of the grounds. Jesus himself was not averse to giving rational evidences for people. You're all familiar with the story of the man, the paralytic, the man with a palsy who's lowered down through the roof of a house in Capernaum. And I'll read you the passage as it appears in Matthew describing that. He entered into a ship and passed over and came into his own city, that is Capernaum or Capernaum. And behold, they brought to him a man sick of the palsy, lying on a bed. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee. And behold, certain of the scribes said within themselves, This man blasphemeth. And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, Wherefore think ye evil in your hearts? For whether is easier, to say, Thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, Arise and walk? But that ye may know that the Son of Man hath power on earth to forgive sins. Then saith he to the sick of the palsy, Arise, take up thy bed, and go into thine house. And he arose and departed to his house. When the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, which had given such power unto men. Now, what's going on here is he's promised the paralytic that his sins are forgiven. And, of course, the Pharisees and scribes say, he doesn't have the authority to do this. By what right does he do this? So that, of course, that claim that sins are forgiven is a non-empirical claim. There's not going to appear any litmus test or anything like that that's going to show that his sins have been forgiven. But Jesus then says, okay, so you'll have reason to believe that I can forgive sins. I'm going to give you a very tangible evidence of my authority and my status with the Father by curing a paralytic. And so the audience there rightly draws the conclusion, my word, if he can do that, then
I think we might have lost you.
Dan, we've lost your audio. Jonathan, do you want to try to help him?
Yeah, I'm looking at it. He's still...
How about now?
As a participant. Oh, yeah, he's back now. Okay.
I looked at it and it said I was muted, but I didn't do anything to mute myself. Now, I was in a flight of unparalleled eloquence right then. So, of course, you missed that, and I can't reproduce it. But I don't know where it cut off. But let me just say that, you know, that Jesus gives them evidence. Did you hear me make that point? What have I got now? A little scene of the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a good thing I have a technician.
Oh, no.
Can you see?
We can hear you and we can see you. Correct. We can hear you and see you, Dan.
But not the PowerPoint.
But not the
and
PowerPoint.
And we're talking about the Matthew. Yeah.
Technology is a wonderful thing, but it isn't always an obedient servant. So let me try all that again. To say that that Jesus gives them reason to believe, and he quite deliberately does that. So it seems to me that we follow in his steps when we try to supply reasons. And I started to say that that the only reasons, the only tangible reasons that the Lord has given us in connection with the Book of Mormon would be the witnesses. You know, there are other wonderful things, and I like to talk about them. My friends, Jack Welch and others, like to talk about them, chiasmus and things like that. But the one set of, if you will, empirical evidence that the Lord himself gave to us, that he mentions in the Book of Mormon, he mentions in the Doctrine and Covenants, has been mentioned in every edition of the Book of Mormon since its first publication in 1830, is the witness testimonies. And so it seems to me that we need to pay serious attention to that, because it obviously matters to the Lord. So it ought to matter to us. And I'm convinced that we haven't really given the witnesses the attention and emphasis that we always ought to have given them. Let me see if I can move forward on this. I'm trying to move us forward to another slide. The film is probably going to be dedicated. It is certainly going to be dedicated because, hey, I'm the executive producer, so it will be dedicated to the memory of Richard Lloyd Anderson, who was by far the premier authority on the witnesses to the Book of Mormon. And one of the things I'm most proud of is we got an interview with Richard not long before he died. He was in his 90s, so I worried a great deal that we might not be able to get him, but we did. And so I consider him, and I think this is the way it's going to read, you know, dedicated to the memory of Richard Lloyd Anderson, a witness to the witnesses, or something to that effect, because that's how I see him. But the movie isn't going to come out right away. This was in our last bout of filming in upstate New York. You can see COVID-19 has interfered. The film will be ready we were going to debut it on October 7th, but now it'll be the spring or the summer. We just don't know. So this has put a little damper on some of our work. But anyway, that's enough of the commercial for it. Some people have asked, well, why didn't the Lord just, you know, show these plates and so on to everybody? Well, his behavior seems to show that's not the way he does it. These little images that I just showed you show he could have had Jesus, the resurrected Lord, appear to the Senate in Rome or in the Colosseum or in the Circus Maximus, but he didn't do that. Instead, Jesus' ministry is concentrated not just in Judea, you know, and which was a backwater of the Roman Empire, but in the Galilee, which was a backwater of a backwater, right? That's the way he seems to do it. So he doesn't try to overwhelm us. And I think it has to do with, here's actually a statement, I guess, that I can quote. This is Peter, an actual photograph. They're rare, and color photographs are extremely rare. Peter meeting the centurion Cornelius. In Caesarea, and Peter explains that that Jesus or that God could have appeared to everybody, but instead he called witnesses. So he says to Cornelius, "Him God raised up the third day and showed him openly, not to all the people, but unto witnesses chosen before God, even to us, who did eat and drink with him after he rose from the dead." Well, that's exactly the same thing he did with the Book of Mormon. He chose witnesses, and that's very significant. I'll try to show, though, that he chose more than the 11 that we normally think of. This may have to do with something that the Anglo-American philosopher of religion, John Hick, called epistemic distance. He says that God could overwhelm us and force our choices if he simply appeared to us, you know, just overwhelm our defenses. But he chooses to maintain this epistemic distance to it's the veil. It's what Latter-day Saints call the veil, in a way. To allow us free choice. There is evidence. There's enough to justify a decision for. There's also probably enough to justify a decision against, if that's the direction you're inclined to go. That is, it's poised somewhat so that we have the freedom of choice. And the reason this picture is there, you may wonder, what in the world does that have to do with epistemic distance? I'm using a story to illustrate it from Søren Kierkegaard, or Kierkegaard, if you want to be really a purist about it. And he told a story to make this point of epistemic distance about a king, a bachelor king, who falls in love with a peasant girl. She doesn't know who he is. And he is concerned that if he reveals who he is to her, she'll be overwhelmed. And he won't know for sure if she says yes to his proposal of marriage, whether she loves him for who he is, or whether she's overawed by his power, his status, his wealth, and all those sorts of things. And so he woos her in disguise. He condescends, in the language of the Book of Mormon, to come to her as a fellow peasant. And when he's sure that she loves him for who he is, then he can disclose who he really is, namely the king of the country. And so I think God does the same thing to us. He wants to know, which way do you incline? What choice do you want to make? I'm not going to blast you or blow you away with overwhelming evidence, but I'm going to give you enough. Here's another Scandinavian illustration of that story. I'm going to give you enough that you have reason to believe, but not enough to compel your assent. Okay, so he wants us to love him for himself. So he is lovable. And people who have the Spirit will sense that he is lovable, and that's one of the ways he draws us to him. All right. Well, back to the hardcore history, I suppose. There's an account from March 1830, just before the church is actually founded in April, on April 6th, of a young Baptist minister who goes to the Peter Whitmer cabin. There he meets several of the witnesses, and he records very early that there are several of the Whitmer boys and a few others who claim to have seen the plates. Three, he says, claim to have heard the voice of God and seen an angel. He doesn't believe it, but he's aware of the story already then. With Joseph Smith and then the three and the eight, you have 12 witnesses. And I think that's not insignificant. I think it may be related to legal ideas of the day. 12 good men and true, right? That's a jury. And so you have a jury swearing to what they've seen. A jury of peers, and I'll try to show, or at least to let you know right now, that these men were a cross-section, in a way, of the community. They were the ordinary people in the community. They are a jury of peers. They're also all male, which I think fits the ideas of the day. I did a little research last year on the idea of women jurors. It was amazing to me how late that idea took hold. Utah was one of the very first places to allow women to serve on juries and to vote. In some states, notably one I won't name it in the South, it wasn't until the mid-1950s that they allowed women to serve as jurors. And so it's amazingly late. So I think the idea of these reliable male jurors and witnesses fit the spirit of the age in many ways. But the Lord's ahead of his time. And so you'll see female witnesses at the end who are, I think, of tremendous importance and undervalued. 12 Good Men and True. You may remember the film from the 50s. It's the 50s with Lee J. Cobb and Henry Fonda called 12 Angry Men about a jury. It's based on a play. But, you know, the thing we often don't think about is it's 12 angry men. And even at that point when that film was made, that was just accepted. That was the way things were. All male juries. All right. We'll talk first about the three witnesses. These are three colorized images, all daguerreotypes, well, photographs, the two on the right, the middle one on the right, of David Whitmer and Martin Harris in old age. Oliver Cowdery, this was kind of an important discovery. This is a daguerreotype of Oliver Cowdery, the actual Oliver Cowdery. We didn't know until fairly recently what he looked like, but that is Oliver. And these have been colorized by a friend of mine. To give them some verisimilitude. We often think of David and Martin as old, but they weren't when this happened. In fact, one of the responses that people had to our film when we first showed them snippets was, oh, your actors are so young. And they said, Joseph Smith, he's too young. I said, okay, think for a minute. How old in these events, 1828, how old do you think he was? He was 23. How old do you think our actor is? He's 23. If the age shocks you, you should be shocked. They were very, very young. Even Martin Harris wasn't all that old, though he was the senior of the others. So let me talk about those three. Here's the testimony. You're all familiar with it. And it's very spiritual. They hear the voice of God. They see an angel, of course. They see the plates. They see other things. And that's remarkable. It's a very spiritual occurrence. It's they hear the audible voice of God. They see the plates. They see the engravings on the plates. They see an angel. The voice of God commands them to bear record of their experience. It's full of supernaturalism. David Whitmer, who was the most interviewed of the witnesses, who lived until 1888 and was interviewed all the time, and he's actually a pivotal figure in our film, both as the young David Whitmer and then the older David Whitmer, who's retelling the story to a reporter in the film. He repeatedly talked about the strange influence, the light that came. He said it was unbelievable. It just filled him with joy. It rooted him to the spot. It was enrapturing. He struggles to find language to express it. So it's very supernatural. I think that's an important thing. You can't explain it by simple mundane forgery. If some conniving blacksmith made some plates, that doesn't explain the experience of the three witnesses. It doesn't even come close. Moreover, and this is a comment from Richard Anderson, those who see the witnesses as victims of simple deception have overlooked the complexity of the experience promised to them and their later spontaneous mention of seeing the other ancient objects with the plates. Okay, so this is what they claim to have seen, right? But you have the Doctrine and Covenants promising them that if they are faithful, they will see all these things. And so there's sort of a checklist of all the things they did see. They saw every single object promised to them in the Doctrine and Covenants. It's not just the plates. It's not just a simple artifact. It's this spectacular industrial light and magic sort of experience with all these different objects. In their experience, they see the breastplate. They see the directors, the Liahona. They see the Urim and Thummim. They see the sword of Laban, all sorts of objects. Now, if you're assuming that there's some guy who's manufacturing these objects, he has really got a specialty metal shop there on the outskirts of Palmyra, just churning this stuff out. And then it all just disappears, right? How does that happen? But some have tried to explain it away as, you know, it was hallucination. Well, there's the list of things that they were promised to see, which they all did see. And they did see all of those items. This is David Whitmer, and he's told, you know, well, maybe you were hallucinating this. Maybe it was imagination. You see him say, I saw them as plain as I see this bed, and he strikes his hand on the bed beside him. And they'll sometimes say to him, well, Mr. Whitmer, maybe they were a long distance away and you just couldn't see them very clearly. He says, no, they were closer to me than you are. You know, I'm not hallucinating here. I know what I saw. Richard Anderson, again, nothing short of biblical Christianity furnishes such a concrete statement of supernatural reality. One cannot dismiss the experience easily, for each man so testifying impressed his community with his capacity and unwavering honesty, and all three consistently reaffirmed the experience in hundreds of interviews throughout their lives. Now let's go to the eight witnesses, because they're very different. Their testimony is restrained. It's legalistic. You know, they saw the plates, which they said had the appearance of gold. They saw the engravings on the plates, which they said had the appearance of ancient work. They never go beyond what they can see. They don't hear a divine voice. They don't see an angel. They don't feel any enrapturing influence. They don't see any supernatural light. And they always refer to Joseph as the said Smith. You know, I mean, it's as detached as you can be. They don't see the sword of Laban or anything like that. No big library of plates, as David Whitmer described. But they talk about hefting the plates. They have a more tactile connection with the plates than the three witnesses do. And the word to heft is really important. It shows up over and over again in the eight witnesses, in individual witness statements from the unofficial witnesses too, who held the plates. They hefted them. And that's significant, because heft always implies heaviness, right? We don't heft butterflies. We don't heft tufts of cotton or anything like that. They're substantial. They're estimated usually as between 40 and 60 pounds in weight. Now, the plates that we used in our film, by the way, this amused me. I've had critics say to me, look, Joseph could not have run through the woods being chased by a mob carrying 40 pounds of gold plates. It's just not physically possible. Well, we had two sets of plates for the filming. We had one set that were 20 pounds and one set that were 40, a little over 40 pounds. And on the day that we filmed him running through the woods, which, by the way, if you've ever been involved with filming, it's amazing how often they have to redo scenes. Not because there's anything wrong, but just to get it from a different angle and so on. So Joseph was climbing the hill and then running down the hill, jumping over logs, running through brush, brushing aside branches and all this sort of thing, carrying these plates. And we said, you know, you don't have to carry the heavy ones. Why don't you, for this scene, carry the 20-pound weight plates? And he said, no, I want this to be realistic. I want to lean the way you'd have to lean to carry the 40 pounds. So he's doing that all day long, which to me proved you can do it, because he did it. He's a young 23-year-old fit guy, but he did it. And so in the film, when you see that scene, which is kind of spectacular, you'll see that his hair is matted with sweat and everything. That was not cosmetics. He really got a workout that day, but he did it for hours, up and down, carrying those plates. But they emphasize the heft. And there's a funny testimony from Martin Harris involving the word heft. At one point, before he's one of the three witnesses, Martin sits with them in the box on his lap. And he said they were really heavy. Several people commented on it. They weren't just a block of wood. They weren't even a rock. They were heavier than that, because gold is very, very heavy. And he says, I knew from the heft that they were lead or gold. And I knew that Joseph had not credit enough to buy so much lead. Now, I've always thought that was funny. I don't know if he meant it as funny, but I knew he didn't have enough money to have that much lead, so it must have been gold, because it was too heavy to be just rock. So, the eight witnesses. And Richard Anderson, again, makes a really good point that these were artisans and farmers. They were used to handling things with their hands. They could estimate weights. They had a sense of what curious workmanship looked like. And they testified that those plates were different than anything they'd ever seen. Okay, B.H. Roberts makes a really good point about the two different sets of witness testimonies that I think needs to be stressed, and I'll give it very briefly, but I stole it from him. Actually, I think I thought of it independently, and then I found out to my horror that B.H. Roberts had already written it up at length in 1930, so oh well. But he says, look, it's the testimonies of the three and the testimonies of the eight are not just something to be added together so you have testimonies of 11. They're different kinds of testimonies. If you try to dismiss the testimony of the three, you say, well, it was hallucination. It was a visionary thing. It wasn't real. Then what do you do with the testimony of the eight? Because they have this matter-of-fact experience at about 1 p.m, just holding those plates in a clearing in the woods and turning the leaves. On the other hand, if you say, well, it was just simple fraud, somebody manufactured a set of plates, that doesn't account for the testimony of the three. So my argument would be that you don't add them together. You don't just double the testimonies. You quadruple them. I mean, that's crude, but in a way, it's not an arithmetic addition. It's a geometric expansion of the difficulties for a critic, because you've got these two radically different kinds of testimony that you have to explain away. And so together, they're much stronger than they would be separately, taken separately, or if they were the same kind of testimony. All right. Now I want to get to the informal or unofficial witnesses, because I think they add a very great deal to this whole issue. And I'm going to take them one by one and then offer a general comment on it. And I'll try to get this. Let's see. I've turned off my phone and I've somehow covered up the time on my computer, so I'll have to find out what time it is. I don't want to go on too long here.
About 20 minutes, or just under 20 minutes.
I think I can do it. Well, William Smith is the first. And again, one of the problems we have is that often the photographs we have make them look really old, because this is toward the end of his life, William Smith, the younger brother of Joseph. But the crucial experiences for him are when he's younger. And he is actually not one of the official witnesses to the Book of Mormon. He was probably too young at the time. Again, I think maybe we're thinking about the qualifications for jurors. He could not have been a juror at that time. But he talks about Joseph bringing the plates home. They were wrapped in a tow rock. And at one point, he hands them to William, the young boy. And William said, you know, I could tell that they were round, or that they weren't round, they were square. He said, I could raise the leaves, sort of like you'd raise the leaves of a book. You could tell that they weren't stone hewn out to deceive, he said, or even a block of wood. They were much heavier than stone, very much heavier than wood. So he's one of the ones that gives us the estimate of the weight, 40 to 60 pounds. And he uses the verb, he says, I hefted them. So William Smith is a witness to the Book of Mormon. Here's a scene that won't be in the film, but it'll be in one of our little snippets. So this is a scene of Josiah Stoll, for whom Joseph worked, who's taking the plates through a window at one point. And this is one that maybe everybody else knew about it, but I had not heard this story, or it just hadn't registered until just a few years ago, really, 4 years ago, maybe. That under oath, when Josiah Stoll is testifying in one of Joseph Smith's trials, Joseph is accused of defrauding a Mr. Stoll. And Stoll says, no, he didn't defraud me. And they said, well, you know, he claims to have had these plates, but you don't know that he really had them. And he says, oh, no, in fact, I do know that he had them. And they say, well, how do you know? And he says, well, because once he handed them to me, covered with cloth, and the cloth came off at the top, and I saw them. And I could see there were metallic plates, that they were inscribed and so on. So I know he had the plates. And this is under oath in a trial. We have the trial transcript. So there you have another witness to the Book of Mormon. And so Josiah Stoll also counts as a witness. Now, here's our Lucy Harris from the film. She also counts unexpectedly as a witness. Lucy Harris is normally, you know, remembered among Latter-day Saints, not very positively. She's the chief suspect in the disappearance of the lost manuscript pages. And she sued Joseph. You saw that one trial scene. She was not a big fan, but she nevertheless is a witness. She came to Joseph at one point, demanded to see the plates. He said she couldn't see them, that he had no right to show them to her. And she said, well, you know, I demand evidence. And he said, well, I don't have any right to give it to you. Ask God. And she was really unhappy left angrily. Lucy Mack Smith records, though, that Lucy Harris came the next day and said she had gotten reamed out in a dream the night before. An angel had come to her in the dream, shown her the plates, and said, you have sought to deny the servant of the Lord. That is not right. And she actually makes a donation of $29, which in today's dollars is about $760. I checked it just a few weeks ago. And so she may be, oddly enough, the very first donor toward the publication of the Book of Mormon, Lucy Harris. So she too counts as a kind of witness to the Book of Mormon. Lucy Mack Smith definitely does. Lucy Mack Smith at one point examined the Urim and Thummim. She said she could see that it was made of two smooth three-cornered diamonds set in glass. They were set in silver bows. And she encountered the breastplate, which she said was wrapped in thin muslin. She could feel it. It was very large. You could feel the strap attached to it and so on. Under very, very matter-of-fact circumstances. Here's a letter from a woman named Sally Parker writing to someone named John Kempton in August 1838. The letter survived, and she describes Lucy Mack Smith. I lived by Joseph Smith's mother, and she was one of the finest of women, always helping them that stood in need. She told me the whole story. I asked her if she saw the plates. She said no, it was not for her to see them, but she hefted and handled them. Again, that verb to heft, which shows up amazingly often. And I believed all she said, for I lived by her 8 months, and she was one of the best of women. So Lucy Mack Smith, too, counts as a witness. Emma Smith, shown here in a scene from the film, one of the scenes to me that is most moving, it's when Joseph is burying their son, Alvin. And she says, Joseph, aren't you a prophet? Couldn't you have stopped this? And he says, it doesn't work that way. She says, well, doesn't God speak to you? He's not right now. He doesn't right now. And it's a really powerful emotional scene. But she can also be counted as a witness because she often had to move the plates around when she was doing her housework. She said she had to lift and move them when she swept and she dusted. And so she says, I know that my husband had the plates. I could feel the outline and shape of the plates. I could feel along the edge. It was like the thick pages of a book. I could feel the top plate. Scrape against the one below and make a metallic sound. I could feel the rings. Still everything okay? Okay. And so that's
hey guys.
Powerful stuff.
The Weary Travelers. Good.
Yes. Got someone else on? Are you hearing someone else?
Please mute your mic if you're yes. not a speaker.
Okay. So now I have to admit, I've always wanted to talk to Emma because she said she was often left alone there in the house with the plates and she's moving them around. She comments on how heavy they were and how she could feel everything. She's spending quality time with them, running her fingers along the edge, moving the top plate against the one below, feeling the rings. And she says she never looked, but I'd really like to ask her, come on, Emma, you know, fess up. Did you look? Because I know what I would have done. I wouldn't have been able to resist, but she says she didn't, but she says she knew that he had the plates. Another witness is Catherine. Here's Catherine in our film. Now, Catherine, the actress playing her is 14 and Catherine was 14. And so we were interested in the fact that she was able to heft those plates, move them over the table, and she had to do it multiple times that day. But she did it. I mean, they can be moved. They're heavy. They're surprisingly heavy, but she could do it. But Catherine Smith was interviewed a great deal throughout her life. And she said, look, they were heavy. But I held them. I staggered under the weight a little bit. And at one point, the mob is after them, after the plates, and she gets the plates from her brother. His thumb was dislocated. He'd been fighting them off. And she takes them in to Sophronia, and they go into the bedroom, their bedroom. They put them under the covers, and then they both climb into bed and pretend to be asleep. The mob comes in, starts searching the house, but leaves the two girls alone because they don't, you know, they have some chivalry. They're going not going to wake them up, but that's where the plates were. But she comments on how heavy they were and how real and tangible they were. And she uses, again, the verb to heft. Now, I know that at least two of you are familiar with this painting. This is a painting of Mary Musselman Whitmer the mother of David Whitmer, who had one of the most remarkable experiences connected with the plates. And there's a backstory to it that's really interesting. We have three sources: her son David, her granddaughter, and her grandson, who all claim independently to have heard this story from her. Mary Whitmer was playing hostess to Oliver and Joseph. They were translating, and then people were coming all the time to find out what was going on. And she had to feed them, and all the men are doing the important things. I think there are a few women today who would still say, this happens, you know? Well, the men are doing the important things, like talking about sports or talking about politics. The women are doing the work. And so at one point, Oliver and Joseph are both basically farm boys, and they just can't stand sitting there all day long dictating and taking dictation. So they would take a break. They went out one day to skip rocks on a pond on the Whitmer farm. And she sees that. And Mary says to herself, you know, they could help me fetch water. They could help milk the cows. They could do some of the work around the farm. Instead, they're skipping rocks on a pond. It's a very human story. And it's at that point she goes out to milk the cows. And she says an old man appeared to her with a knapsack. And he said, you know, you're under a lot of stress and toil. And it's only fair that you should have a view of the plates. And so he shows her the plates and he turns the pages and she sees them. She never complains after this. She says he then disappeared. She never saw him again, didn't know where he'd come from. But it's a wonderful story. And it seems to be prior to the experiences of the three or the eight or any of the other witnesses. In other words, like the story of the women at the tomb, the very first witness of the plates is not the official witnesses, not the men, it's a woman. It's Mary Whitmer, and she remains faithful to the Book of Mormon until her dying day in 1856. But everybody in her family knew that story and treasured it, and they all believed her. So it's remarkable, really. Now, here are the informal witnesses that I've listed. And there are a few others I could talk about, but these will do. And I think there's some important things that need to be said about them. First of all, I talked about the idea of jurors, the jury of 12 strong men and true. But here you have, of these unofficial witnesses, there are six of them I've listed, but four are women. In an age when women couldn't serve as jurors, I think that it wouldn't have done much good to have them on the list of the official witnesses, because nobody, until in some states 1954, would have credited them. Likewise, in ancient Palestine, the testimony of the witnesses, the female witnesses at the tomb, was not acceptable. You notice that when Paul, a Pharisee, gives his list of witnesses in 1 Corinthians 15, it's all the men. The women at the tomb are not mentioned. He's too good a Pharisaic lawyer to not to realize that it would be worthless. Why even bring it up? They'd be dismissed as hysterical. You know, you can't rely upon them. Their testimony was not acceptable in a first century Jewish court. But here you have women witnesses. Now, there's some other things that need to be said. The official witnesses are sometimes dismissed as, well, they went out expecting to have a miraculous experience. They were already believers. So, of course, they had one. I don't think that really explains it, but you can try that argument. You can't try that argument for the unofficial witnesses. They weren't expecting anything. William Smith, Catherine Smith, had this heavy object thrust at them, right? Lucy Harris has a dream she didn't expect. Lucy Mack Smith spends time just looking at these things. Emma Smith is dusting and cleaning the table. It's not a time of spiritual intensity or expecting a vision or anything like that. Mary Whitmer is actually in a foul mood. She's not feeling spiritual at all. She wants to kick these two slackers off her property. And then she has this experience which she really didn't expect. So you can't use that explanation. Another explanation that some people try to use is group dynamics. People work themselves into a group vision, for which, by the way, I can find no medical evidence that group hallucinations don't happen. They just don't happen. There's no mention in any medical literature of group shared hallucinations. But some people have tried that. They try that with the resurrection narrative of Christ, too. But in this case, you can't even try it because most of these experiences, all of them, are individual. They're solitary. Mary Whitmer's in the barn alone until the old man shows up. There's nothing going on that gives them this experience that where people are praying and seeking one. So it seems to me that the informal witnesses are more important than I had realized even when I began seriously thinking about them about a year and a half ago. I still didn't realize that they weren't just additional witnesses. They are different witnesses. They again make the task of the critic harder, it seems to me. That's one thing I would say about them. And so one of the promises I have made is that although we can't in the film do more than the three witnesses, really, I mean, by the time you have four protagonists, it's getting pretty hard anyway. But we're going to do the eight witnesses in the documentary. And one prominent church historian said, promise me you're going to do the women witnesses. I said, absolutely. That's one of my goals with this. We're going to talk about them. And explain how important they are, not just as additional witnesses, but as different kind, qualitatively different kinds of witnesses. All right. Well, I'm just about done. Don't worry. I wanted to close partly with a couple of short things about Martin Harris. Late in his life, he's visited by an LDS missionary who's on his way to England. Martin Harris is sick. He hasn't eaten in 3 days. But as soon as he realizes who this man is, Elder David Dill, he says, are you going to England? He gets up out of bed. He gets dressed. He eats. He says, take me to England with you. He says, you preach and I'll bear testimony of the Book of Mormon and we'll convert all England. And then just before he dies, he's speaking to his bishop and he says, I'm glad you've come because I want to tell you so that you will tell the world that on my deathbed, I bore witness of the Book of Mormon. I want that to go to all the world. And it seems to me that it has in a way. I mean, as I say, it's in every edition of the Book of Mormon in every language since 1830. That's always, even in the selections in Arabic and Persian and so on, they'd go to the witnesses. The witnesses were there. But the story needs to be told and needs to be appreciated more, I think, even by Latter-day Saints, and needs to be taken to the world. In a way stronger than we have, because these are amazing witnesses. I am winding down, but things start coming to me. It's pretty much stream of consciousness here, right? I remember a debate that I was in years ago with, there were five Latter-day Saints and five evangelicals, including, several that were really quite prominent. William Lane Craig was probably the most prominent evangelical philosopher in the English-speaking world, and one of the leading philosophers of religion in the world. And at one point, Craig, whom I really respect, he's wonderfully brilliant and an excellent debater, formidable, said, well, the difference between Mormonism and Christianity, and that's the way he put it, is that Christianity has 11 reputable witnesses, and Mormonism has nothing like that. And I was to respond to William Lane Craig, and I remember looking at the moderator of the debate, Richard Mao, who was the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, and Richard just looked back at me and rolled his eyes, because it was as if Craig had just pinned a kick me sign on his posterior. Because I got up and I said, look, not only do we have reputable witnesses, even the number, 11, you know, you say we have nothing like that, we have things precisely like that, well documented. And that information needs to get out there. But I hear even Latter-day Saints saying sometimes, and this has become fashionable lately, well, the witnesses never actually claim to have seen the plates with their literal eyes or to have handled them with their actual hands. It was all spiritual. It was just like a dream or a vision or something like that. That is flatly not true. I mean, Hiram Smith goes out of his way at one point. He could be addressing some modern critics. He says, I saw with these eyes. I touched with these hands. What else can he say? I don't know what else he can say stronger than that. They're trying to make the point, and that's why I've made the point ad nauseum about the verb to heft. They held them. They turned the pages, the eight witnesses in particular. And so you can't dismiss this as just hallucination or wishful thinking, or, you know, only with spiritual eyes. Martin Harris used that phrase, but he didn't mean less than physical vision. He meant more than ordinary vision. He saw an angel. He saw all sorts of things in a vision, but he didn't mean that he didn't really see the plates. And anyway, the eight witnesses, that's all they claim, is they saw and handled the physical plates. So Book of Mormon's been translated into a whole bunch of languages. The testimony of the witnesses goes everywhere with it. But this film is an attempt to get that message out and to start a conversation. We want to follow it up with the documentary and all the other things. I really want members of the church to recognize how powerful this testimony is. I like this statement from what I regard as one of the great books ever written by any Latter-day Saint scholar. And that's Richard Anderson's Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses, where he says, "This is no testimony of direct revelation in the world's history is better documented than the testimony of the Book of Mormon witnesses." And that's true. We know a huge amount about them, and they stood by it. They were reputable. One image that I want to show and have shown in another context is the image of David Whitmer's grave marker in Richmond, Missouri. Maybe some of you have been there. It's really impressive to me because David gave orders that this was to be erected on his tomb when he died in 1888, the last surviving witness. And it says on one side, the testimony of the Jews and the testimony of the Nephites are one. Truth is eternal. He bore his testimony even after death. And this is funny because one of the most powerful arguments I ever heard against the credibility of David Whitmer was this. Someone said to me, you know, David was just terrified of Brigham Young. He knew that Brigham would have him done in if he ever told the sordid truth about the Book of Mormon. Well, Brigham has been dead for 11 years by the time David dies. David has 11 years to come forward if that's really the truth. But he even wants his testimony to be born after his death. I mean, did he really believe it? You saw the scene in the movie where he's got guns aimed at his chest and he has the chance to deny the Book of Mormon and he doesn't. He's a really impressive witness, and they're all really impressive. And I really, really want members of the church and interested investigators and the world to know how impressive they are and how firm that testimony is. 12 official witnesses, including Joseph, enough to send a person to the gallows, which reminds me, and then I'll close. When David Whitmer died, there was a person that was interviewed by a newspaper in Chicago, one of the leading newspapers of the day, and they just called him a Missouri man. But he had lived in Richmond, Missouri, and he knew David Whitmer. And so this Chicago paper wants to know in 1888, well, what about David Whitmer? What was he like? And he says, well, one interesting thing that he says is David Whitmer's testimony would have sent a man to the gallows faster than that of any other man I've ever known, by which he meant you would take him seriously in matters of life and death. And he said he was always a loser and never a gainer by his testimony. And we were always puzzled by his testimony because they elected him mayor of Richmond and so on in a place that didn't like Latter-day Saints. But they trusted him. They just couldn't figure out what to make of his testimony. Well, I think Latter-day Saints have a really clear understanding of what to make of it. He was telling the truth. He knew it. And I bear you my testimony that he was telling the truth, that these are credible witnesses. They hold up to investigation. They sustain examination. And the Lord didn't choose them for nothing. He didn't emphasize this testimony for nothing. And we should value it and appreciate it. They sacrificed a great deal for their testimonies. And their credibility is...
Dan, we just lost you again.
Oh.
You're back.
Oh, did
we got it to their credibilities. You got it right up to there. It's only been 30 seconds.
Okay. I was just bearing my testimony that their testimonies bear scrutiny. They can withstand examination. And I want to bear my testimony too. The Book of Mormon is true and that the witnesses are credible. And the more I've looked at them, the more impressed by them I am. And I don't really see a way around them. There's not, to my mind, a credible way of dismissing them. And the fact that all three of the three witnesses left the church and then two came back, that strengthens their credibility. It doesn't weaken it. The reasons they left the church had nothing to do with the Book of Mormon. Even at their worst, they bear testimony. John Whitmer is one of my favorites. At his worst moment, 3 weeks maybe after he's excommunicated, He's tracked down by Theodore Turley, who runs into him in Missouri. Theodore Turley has been sent to sell the Mormon property in Missouri, try to recover some money for the saints in Illinois. And he runs into John Whitmer, and he says, "Brother Whitmer, you were one of the witnesses to the Book of Mormon. Do you no longer believe it's true?" And John Whitmer is at his absolute worst. He's really bitter. And he says, "I don't know if the Book of Mormon's true or not. I couldn't read what was on those plates." So at his worst, he never heard a divine voice. He didn't see an angel. He just saw some metal objects with odd writing on them. Now, he bounces back really quickly. He bears testimony until the day he dies. But at his absolute worst, he still is bearing testimony to the one thing he knows uniquely, which is there were plates. And he provides an estimate of the weight, again, about 45, 50 pounds, he says. So he says what he needs to say. He never backs away from it. None of the witnesses ever do. And that, to me, is powerfully persuasive. Oh. Anyway.
Thank you so much. You have been powerfully persuasive in your testimony as well.
Well, I hope so.
Are so honored to have had you, especially that most of you don't know, he just got back from a trip. He's exhausted. It's an hour later than it is in the Bay Area right now. And as you were just closing up with your beautiful witness about David Whitmer, I was reminded in the New Testament that the Lord had the priesthood holder, Zacharias, dumb. And his witness being dumb was, I believe, stronger than if he had come out and said, "I saw a vision." And I see that with David Whitmer. But Oliver and Martin came back. And it's not like they ever left their faith in this part of it. What they lost was their faith that prophets are infallible and their faith that God asks us to do harder things than we could have ever imagined, which I believe was the case of Plural Bear. But God bless you, Dan, in all of your great work. And I hope all of us will become cheerleaders for this upcoming movie. And I'm really grateful to introduce you also, in case you have not been looking at The Interpreter, but take it as part of your research and your study. When you want to find out more information, go there and use their links to study to find greater answers to your questions. It's a fabulous resource. And we are so blessed to have had this evening. Thank you for your witness and for a refresher of those great witnesses in the 19th century. Katie, can you give us our closing prayer? Thank you.